I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Media Confidential, your weekly deep dive behind the headlines, beyond the clickbait of the contested world of the media. I'm Alan Rossbridger.
And I'm Lionel Barber. Today, Nick Davis is back with more on the phone hacking scandal and new explosive revelations since this broadcast last week.
Nick was the journalist who broke the phone hacking story, and he's again pulling together the strands from the scandal as new information emerges all the time. On our previous episode, he detailed the extraordinary lengths taken to hack the phones of politicians, even during the Leveson inquiry. And now there is still more to say.
And later we're joined by Branko Burkic, editor-in-chief and founder of South Africa's Daily Maverick, an online news service that attracts around 10 million visitors a month. Branko, who is an intrepid investigative journalist, will be talking about the role of the media in democracy and some of his own great investigative stories. So, Alan, last week's episode was full of revelations from Nick Davis, and there's more.
Yeah, we published two big pieces in the magazine, Prospect Magazine, but since then we've published four more pieces, which we're going to talk to Nick about. The usual legal disclaimer that this is all based on documents that have come out during assorted court cases. There have been about 1,600 so far, and they are allegations. And it's just important to say that because, except with the Mirror Group cases, which have been settled by a judge, this is a situation where Nick is reporting on the evidence that has come out and what one side says about them. So that's just the legal disclaimer. So it's great to have Nick Davis back after his triumph of reporting last week. And there are four further pieces that we have been publishing this week. And perhaps we can just go through them, Nick. The first one is the crucial question about Rupert Murdoch himself. What are the allegations about Rupert Murdoch and what he knew and when did he know it?
So really the most important single piece of new evidence focuses on a single day, January the 24th, 2011. It's the day before the new police inquiry into phone hacking, Operation Weeting, is triggered. There's a state of great panic and alarm round at the Murdoch headquarters in London. And on that day, the 24th of January, we know that Rupert Murdoch flew in. Now also we can see internal emails from Rebecca Brooks in particular saying, when Rupert arrives, I'm going to tell him everything. And two other people are going to brief him about the strategy. Now, the significance of that is that on the very next day, they started to delete 11 million email messages. And this is exactly at the same time as the police are starting their new inquiry. Now, there's two significant points about this. First, if the Murdoch company wants to say, we only deleted emails because we were trying to free up our servers, the timing of that massive deletion does make that answer very, very hard to accept. And the second thing is that because it happened after Rupert has arrived in London, after we can see through these emails, he's being briefed and they're going to discuss the strategy with him, it's reasonable to ask whether his fingerprints aren't on that decision. And if the most harsh interpretation of that deletion is correct, he's not many steps away from being accused of perverting the course of justice, bearing in mind this is evidence on which there's not yet a judgment. But I've not previously seen evidence which has brought him so close to allegations of crime. Previously, he's always been able to say, I'm so high up the tree, I can't see what's happening on the ground. Well, he's much, much closer to events on this particular day in January 2011.
And is there an official response from the Murdoch organization?
No, it's odd. I keep putting the stories to them and they keep recycling a rather pointless statement that they gave to the press back in March. Our lawyer says that she understands why they're doing that, but I don't.
Okay. And the other curious thing I noticed in your story, you lead off with the fact that in 2014, it looked as though Murdoch was going to be called in and interviewed under caution. In fact, we published a story to that effect at The Guardian. And you say that this never happened.
Yes, it was stronger than it looks as though Rupert was due to be called in. I had multiple sources that were saying Scotland Yard have told Rupert Murdoch, listen, mate, we want to interview you under caution as a suspect. And Murdoch's lawyers had persuaded them to wait until the end of the big hacking trial with Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson. When that moment arrived, we had the story on the front page of The Guardian. Murdoch's lawyers got terribly cross. And the Metropolitan Police decided not to interview him after all. All that happened was that the Met Police set up a leaks inquiry and contacted me to say, effectively, where did you get that story from? Well, that's quite useful from my point of view because implicitly it confirms that the story was correct. But also, look at the priorities. They didn't interview their own suspect because he happens to be one of the most powerful men on the planet and he's got very aggressive lawyers. I mean, that does not happen very often, but instead they go after the leak. I should point out, actually, while we're on the record, that there were people in New York who knew all about that. Their assumption that it must have been somebody from the Metropolitan Police who leaked it was itself faulty.
Now, Nick, you've talked about that crucial exchange between Rupert Murdoch, arrived in London, with Rebecca Brooks, who was obviously running the News UK operation, former editor of The Sun. Let's talk about another character, key character, Will Lewis.
Okay.
Former FT journalist, former colleague of mine, actually, who had worked at the Sunday Times, then went to be editor of the Telegraph, brought back to help in what could be described as a cleanup operation. What do we know about his role and maybe some of the questionable behavior?
So in some of these documents that have been deployed in the High Court, there are some pretty serious allegations made against Will Lewis, principally that he, quote, perverted the course of justice. And that is firstly because of his alleged role in organizing the deletion of millions of emails, which clearly would have been of great interest to the police, but also because he was appointed, along with his number two, Simon Greenberg, as the liaison between the Murdoch company and the new police operation investigating the hacking. And the police, according to the documents lodged in court, came to the conclusion that he was not behaving in a trustworthy way. And there's a particular example of this. In July 2011, 5 or 6 months after that police operation was launched, they went into the Murdoch building, into the News of the World newsroom, and they seized 125 items of what they call office furniture. This is filing cabinets and desk drawers and crates of paperwork. And they put it into a sealed part of the office and actually officially designated it a crime scene. And they put Will Lewis and Simon Greenberg in charge of making sure that that area was secure. Some weeks later, they came back and worked their way through all these 125 items. And at the end of it, they said, that's odd, there's only 117. 8 of those big filing cabinets, which had been seized from the office of the editor and the managing editor, the two most important journalists on the paper, had gone missing from the secure area, which Will Lewis and Simon Greenberg were responsible for. And the police say, in these documents which were deployed in court, why didn't he tell us? Why didn't he tell us that 8 things had gone missing? So this doesn't mean that he conspired to get rid of them. It does mean that he's accused of conspiring to get rid of them. And the question is being asked of him.
And have we got an answer from, let it be said, Sir William Lewis, because he earned a knighthood under Boris Johnson and is now in a very important position as publisher of The Washington Post, appointed by Jeff Bezos, the former founder and CEO of Amazon.
Will Lewis's line, repeatedly actually, has been that he's not going to discuss these matters from the past. And that's as much as he's said so far.
Okay, so that's the Will Lewis story. The third story is about payoffs, and it's in effect a story about allegations that the Murdoch company bought the silence of key people.
Some of these payoffs were already known about, but what's interesting here is that we can now see that three of the senior journalists who were convicted of phone hacking and punished by the court then sued or went to an employment tribunal to complain that they had been wrongly dismissed. Now, if you've been found guilty of committing criminal offences in the course of your employment, you're not going to get very far at an employment tribunal. And they weren't getting very far. What the documents deployed in court show is that those three people amended their original statements in order to make allegations specifically and personally against Rebecca Brooks, who at that time had recently returned as the chief executive of the Murdoch UK operation. And following those amendments, they were paid, according to these documents, quote, hundreds of thousands of pounds in compensation for their lost employment. So again, it's a matter of throwing up questions which need to be answered. Why would any company pay out hundreds of thousands of pounds to senior employees whose case for wrongful employment was apparently so weak?
And do we know that they had to sign NDAs?
The court documents say yes, that it was part of the deal that they had a gagging clause.
And this story says, because the contrast between how the upper echelons of the Murdoch organisation were treated and the people at the lower end of the organisation, but Rebecca Brooks, you say it's estimated she got a nearly £11 million payoff at the time that she left the company and then she rejoined the company.
Yes, that, we need to be clear, isn't actually new. Soon after she resigned, soon after her arrest in the summer of 2011, it was disclosed that this enormous payoff or something along those lines had been paid. I don't think anybody's actually got the precise figure. So we, in relation to that, we've simply recycled what had previously been reported. I'm not claiming to know anything new about that.
And the final story that you've put together, and in a way I found this one of the more shocking stories, and to be clear, this is about Mirror Group newspapers as well as the news. It was just how recent this went on, well through the Leveson inquiry and suggests that they just didn't care.
So my experience as a reporter working on this for years and now coming back to it is that I realise I was naive.
Hard to believe, Nick, but carry on.
No, but it's true. My imagination simply didn't catch up with the recklessness, you could say the ruthlessness, of these newspapers. So what we can see now is that the three Mirror Group titles and The Sun, round there at Murdoch HQ, carried on using unlawful methods, including voicemail hacking, to get stories long after we all thought they'd stop. We thought they'd stop with the arrest of Clive Goodman, the News of the World's royal correspondent, and Glenn Mulcair. That's back in August 2006. But we can see that even when The Guardian was uncovering it, when the new Scotland Yard inquiry was investigating them, when Lord Justice Leveson is taking evidence about them, they carried on hacking those three Mirror Group titles and The Sun. Unlawful stuff. It's close to crazy. If you imagine, you know, you're a burglar who's going out burgling, you realise the police are sitting outside your house watching you. Guess what? I'll go out and do some burglary. And so it's very, very hard to understand. But there's a point here as well. We can see them doing this up to around the end of 2011. That's the point at which the evidence stops. We don't know that that's the point at which the criminality stops. It's simply that the High Court hasn't disclosed, ordered the Murdoch company or the Mirror company to disclose anything beyond that point. It's also worth making aware the Mirror Group is concerned. We're not dealing in untested allegation. In that case, with Prince Harry at the head of the litigation, we've actually got a judgment by Mr. Justice Fancourt, who says in terms what we've just said. Amazingly enough, these guys
And Fancourt is scathing about the evidence, especially the Mirror Group executives gave. Bluntly, he doesn't believe them.
As High Court judges go, he is pretty rude about Sly Bailey, the chief executive, and Paul Vickers, the legal manager. I mean, he accuses them of some pretty bad faith failure to tell the truth. And his language is actually stronger than mine, but let him speak for himself. There's another thing, actually, we're going to have a look at with a story that's coming out quite soon, which is about the Press Complaints Commission. And I don't want to steal too much of what has not yet been published, but it's really interesting to see the way in which the PCC was populated by people with a criminal history.
Yeah, that's a very startling thing to say. Tell us.
Well, so the most interesting single example is the long-term former editor of the Sunday Mirror, Tina Weaver. Mr. Justice Fancourt, in making his ruling on the evidence he was shown about the Mirror Group titles, is absolutely unforgiving of Tina Weaver. He says she was a phone hacker. She organized it and she did it herself. That's his judgment, not an untested allegation. That's the High Court judgment. Tina Weaver was part of the Press Complaints Commission, which originally looked at the allegation that the News of the World had been breaking the law by phone hacking and hadn't told the truth about it. And she was involved in producing the report, which said, effectively, nothing to see here.
Well, it went further than that. Said if anybody was making stuff up, it was The Guardian.
That's the second report.
Oh, right.
Which is just as bad and for different reasons.
Yeah,
it takes you to the heart, actually, of the whole point that Lord Justice Leveson was trying to get across, which is, you know, he was saying, let's have another round of self-regulation. But look, we know from the past that you can't trust these people to be honest. They were thoroughly dishonest about phone hacking because there was a hacker or two actually involved in their process. So he wanted this independent body to be able to come in and check every so often that self-regulation was working in an honest and independent way. And the more you look at the criminality and the failure of the press regulator, the more you see, A, how necessary it is to have an independent scrutineer, and B, you can see exactly why those newspapers don't want it.
Nick, that's terrific. Thank you for coming back. We may even call you back another time as this series unravels.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. And I think the answer is we will call you back.
Oh, my God.
For more evidence, thank you, Nick.
Okay, all right, good to talk. Be in touch.
Just for the record, we should say that Nick approached Will Lewis to see if he wanted to respond in any way to these allegations that have emerged in court documents, and he responded that he had no comment.
Well, Alan, we all know about the Watergate test for an investigative story, which is what did he know, when did he know it? And that's what I found initially so gripping about Nick kind of setting up a chronology of what went on, and in particular Rupert Murdoch's role at the height of the crisis as he jets into London to talk with Rebecca Brooks, former editor of Sun, and then who was running News UK.
Of course, we remember the media scrum around Murdoch's arrival. But it is kind of fascinating now to be able to see, peek behind the curtain and see what they were talking about and what was happening, particularly in terms of dumping the evidence.
Worth remembering, too, that the drastic decision in a way to set up a firewall was to close down the News of the World, one of the tabloids, which was at the center of the phone hacking.
Which Murdoch has since said was a kind of overreaction. It was a kind of panic. That tells you something about the extent of the sheer, I don't know, it must have been anger and astonishment at what was going on in terms of what was being reported at the time.
I think the other point, Alan, is that when you talk about payouts, we know a lot about the big money settlements with celebrities. We know that Hugh Grant, Mr. Love Actually, had said he couldn't afford to go through all the way through the courts, and he took a big settlement, undisclosed. But what's interesting is that Nick's now identifying pretty substantial financial payouts to former journalists who were either lost their jobs as a result of this phone hacking scandal and were very unhappy with Rebecca Brooks.
The other thing that came out of what Nick has just been talking about, and you will remember this time, Lionel, after the Leveson inquiry was announced, and it was obvious that the Press Complaints Commission was a busted flush. I mean, it had failed to investigate. It had even gone so far as to blame The Guardian rather than News of the World. And then there were all these smoke-filled rooms, metaphorically, because I think even by then people had stopped smoking. But we were summoned to work out what Fleet Street wanted to do, and they wanted to get the fix in before Leveson got his own. I remember those were being led by Paul Vickers, who was...
He was in the room. It was led by Paul Dacre.
Well, the two Pauls. But I remember several meetings where Paul Vickers was up the front of the room.
Yes.
And, you know, the judge, Mr. Justice Fancourt, has come out and said Paul Vickers was not to be trusted. He knew about all the phone hacking all along.
Well, I remember the meeting in the Chancery Lane Hotel where you turned up 20 minutes late, Alan. This was amongst editors. I'm sure you were making a statement.
You're confusing the meetings. I turned up 20 minutes late to the meeting with the Prime Minister.
No, you also turned up 20 minutes late for the meeting with Paul Dacre. You're rewriting history.
Your memory is faulty.
I remember Paul Dacre looking around the room, looking at me, looking at Paul Vickers, and saying, I'd like to tank. And I had this image of a sort of mafia don. I'd like to tank Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago. It was really something else. And then you turned up, which was, I guess, somewhere in the Midwest. This is Media Confidential from Prospect Magazine. And coming up, the South African news service, which went offline for 24 hours to highlight the country's crisis in journalism.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
In this week's Prospect podcast, Deputy Editor Ellen Halliday is joined by political journalist and broadcaster Peter Kellner to take stock of the local election results and analyse what they tell us about the forthcoming general election.
Roughly speaking, when you convert the local election results as if people in those areas were voting in a general election, and you look at the ups and downs area by area since 2019, it amounts to roughly a 10% swing from Conservative to Labour compared with 2019. That is a big swing. The last general election where we had a swing of that size was the Blair landslide in 1997. On its own, if it was happening in every seat, it doesn't actually quite give Labour a majority, because in reality, when you look below the surface, Labour did very well and is on course for a majority.
You can hear that in full on the Prospect podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Now, I just want to make a little plea here, because we've heard from Nick Davis and the 4 new pieces that we've put up on the website, in addition to the 2 really long reads in the magazine. I think Nick worked on those pieces for the best part of 2 months. And if you want to support that kind of investigative journalism, the best way of doing it is to take out a subscription to Prospect. There are a number of ways of doing that. You can take out a digital subscription to Prospect, and you can enjoy a 1 month free trial and get all our digital content, and you'll immediately get access to that kind of journalism, rigorously fact-checked, truly independent, analysis, digging, perspectives. There's no commitment. You can cancel at any time. If you want to take advantage of that offer, visit our website or go to your favorite search engine and search for Prospect Magazine subscription. And every subscription will help us dig deeper.
Without journalism, our democracy and economy will break down. Journalism helped save South Africa. Now we need your help. That was the message on the Daily Maverick website on Monday, 15th of April, with links encouraging readers to become paid subscribers. The rest of the South African news service was down.
The Daily Maverick operates a membership service similar to that of The Guardian. It has nearly 28,000 members, but that number is way short of the nearer to 10 million people who read the site every month.
The economics of digital journalism has been the key issue across the media world for some decades, but the Daily Maverick wants everybody to know how vital journalism is in a democracy like South Africa, which is ravaged by corruption. there are estimates that South Africa has lost 70% of its journalists since 2009. So who or what is filling that vacuum?
With us now is the editor-in-chief of the Daily Maverick, Branko Brkić, to talk about the crisis facing the media, not just in South Africa, but globally.
So, Branko, before we talk about the media in general, and particularly in South Africa, we're all going to hear that wonderful accent that I believe comes from Serbia. And can you just explain to us how you ended up in South Africa?
It does come from Serbia in today's world, but I prefer to actually consider myself still Yugoslavian. I grew up in Yugoslavia, it shaped me, and I still feel Yugoslavian, although that country does not exist anymore. I was a book publisher in Yugoslavia until 1991. I published my first book in 1984. Ran away from it after I was politely asked to join the Yugoslavian army in a civil war against Croatia. I wasn't going to fight my brothers, and I found myself in South Africa on the other side of the world on Friday, 13th of December, 1991. And I had a one-month tourist visa. I couldn't speak English. I can't speak English now, as you could see again.
Don't be too hard on yourself.
I didn't know anybody in South Africa, or nothing about South Africa.
So you managed to get a few jobs and then ended up in publishing, I believe the editor of the National Parks magazine, but then you went into full-time journalism and created something called the Daily Maverick. So what was special about that?
First, Daily Maverick was started after my previous magazines, Maverick and Empire, collapsed in September 2009. And Daily Maverick was created out of necessity to start with. I wanted to first come back to publishing, and that was obviously impossible to do it in print in those days. And second thing, I wanted to actually bring quality to online, which in those days, it wasn't necessarily the case. The quality journalism was reserved for print because that's where the money was, that's where the revenues were. And online was considered more of a, let's say, call it a garbage can where you throw everything in and let the readers wade through it in search of quality. So the idea was for Daily Maverick to bring the quality of Maverick magazine on a daily basis and to actually bring the readers to online.
And you did some amazing investigative journalism. Tell us a little bit about that. I think the first really big exposure where Daily Maverick went where nobody else was prepared to tread, which was the Marikani massacre.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we managed to build a bit of an audience until 2012, in those 3 years. And then on 16th of August 2012, there was this horrifying massacre in Marikana mine in the northwest province in South Africa, where the police mobbed up 34 strikers, and quite a few of them in front of live TV. That's where I saw for the first time how depleted the talent of the then mainstream media turned out to be, because they could afford only to send journalists to the police press conferences. And what we've done something that was completely opposite. We actually went into communities that were devastated and ravaged, first by strike and afterwards by the killings. And our most famous journalist in those days, Greg Marinovich, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner as a photographer from Soweto in late 80s and early 90s, he discovered the second killing field and managed to, over the period of 2 weeks, to completely deconstruct the narrative created by the police and, unfortunately, followed by the mainstream media. So 2 weeks after the massacre, we managed to publish this big expose in which we have proven that this was not an act of self-defense from the police, but the actual murder. And as you mentioned, we've been faced with almost a unanimous cold shoulder by the rest of the media, because not only that we came up with something which was almost impossible for them to think about police shooting their own people, it was also the fact that they themselves reporting completely opposite for the 2 weeks. So that was the first big breakthrough.
And you followed that with some major, intrepid, I must say, investigative reporting into corruption in South Africa, exposing the Gupta brothers, state capture, but also the involvement of London-based companies, public relations firm Bell Pottinger, I think, and then these consultancies, Bain and McKinsey.
You know, my job, I must admit, was filled with meaning, but sometimes there's a lot of pleasure in it. It was a great pleasure
explicit. Alan knows about that with some of his investigations.
I presume so.
Scars on my back.
I presume so. So we were lucky enough to get hold of a hard drive that used to belong to the Gupta brothers, main lieutenant, with I think around 180,000 emails. And after 75 exposés, we managed to thoroughly deconstruct the whole structure and expose them. And Gupta brothers left the country, and President Zuma lost his job in February 2018, which was some 10 months after I got this first hard drive.
And they're now in the Gulf.
They're now safely in exile. They're basically now commuting between India and Gulf, and they also have a Vanuatu passport. And Dubai is serving as their safe harbor, even if South Africa actually did requested that them be extradited. It was refused. So the Guptas and the Zuma and the local lieutenants in South Africa didn't do it on their own. They were assisted by the major international groups. And again, McKinsey is the first that comes to mind. Even software giants like SAP, SAP come to mind. And but again, the greatest pleasure was exposing the role of that Bell Pottinger played.
It was an amazing story. When you look back over the difficulties that you face, I mean, traditionally, someone in your position is going to suffer government repression, they're going to suffer legal fights and the cost of those, and they're going to suffer economic fragility. And how do you rank those in terms of the barriers that you've had to overcome?
Look, I first and foremost, I need to state that we are still fully free in South Africa to express ourselves. Yes, they complain about what we're talking about. They attack us on a number of platforms. They attack us in the most vicious ways. My female journalists especially are exposed to those attacks. And one of them, Marianne Tam, her home was burgled, believe it or not, by crime intelligence, by the police itself. Cool. But somehow those are easier to sustain than the economic insecurity. And again, this doesn't mean that in the next 2 months things are not going to change. The Ramaphosa government and the parliament have now brought in and passed some really scary state security laws that are taking a cue from Russia, from Putin's and Orban's laws, especially in dealing with the NGOs and the funding of the NGOs, and they're giving state security massive right to be intrusive. So all I just told you might be consigned to the past. But the biggest problem is the financial issue.
In that statement that you published on the day that you suspended publication, you talked about how crucial the press had been in winning freedom for South Africa from apartheid. Why do you think that, I mean, this is not a story that's unique to South Africa, but why are people not rallying to the cause of the free press, and they don't feel that the press is sufficiently on their side today?
First, we as a press, we were not very good in explaining what we do. Long time ago, we should have given up on any other place in society educating the people in media literacy. And we should have been much louder, and we should have taken a much stronger stance against the rise of social media and their capabilities, and especially their business models, that without any responsibilities took literally lifeblood out of us. So it is partly our fault.
You're talking about the big data giants,
big tech, Google, Meta, Facebook. Especially social media as well. And we are genuinely under massive disinformation attack by the mostly state actors, and they're using those big tech platforms that we mentioned, using them really with a great effect. So all of those things put together brought us into this very perilous situation where we are actually facing extinction.
You've got 28,000 still?
After the shutdown, that number is much closer to 30,000, thankfully.
To 30,000?
Yes.
So the shutdown prospect, Alan, and then prospect for months, see what anybody
We got a lot of people actually deciding to help us.
Okay, so it had an effect. It was a kind of wake-up call.
It was. Look, let's be honest. We have anything between 10 and 12 million unique visitors a month in Daily Maverick, and only less than 30,000 people support us. Just to clarify, our model is similar to Guardian's. We are free to everybody. We ask readers who can afford to help us and to support our cause, because unfortunately, people of South Africa are poor and cannot afford to pay paywalls. But there's another philosophical and ethical issue that to us is very important. We don't believe that poor people should not know the truth. we don't believe that you should be entitled to your truth only if you can afford it. So I'm sure I'm going to offend Mr. Barber on this one, because
you can call me Lionel.
I did
in favor of paywalls for FT.
I did read your angry conversation with people who are sharing passwords. But the reality is that South Africa cannot afford the paywalls. It just cannot. And we believe that what we do is a public service in an extremely difficult and dangerous moment of our history.
How many news organizations have managed to create a business with paywalls? Is it just a tiny elite?
In South Africa, almost none.
Yeah.
Or I think none. Look, today, if your business is paywall, you survive only if you are humongous, like the New York Times. Or are you specific and incredibly specialized, like the information in or PAC or people like that again in the US? But majority of the media is in the middle, not humongous and not small, you know. And what's going to happen to them? So, you know, I think the whole societies are now with you for this discussion about what does media do for the society and for the democracies and civilization.
You were talking about that earlier with me, Branko.
Yeah.
Tell us what can be done. I mean, you clearly see media as having a role beyond, if you like, dispensing information. You're talking about a bigger role where media almost stands at the center of democracy, Western style, and must articulate that role. Yeah. And get more engaged.
Yeah, look, I mean, when you speak about the role that media plays, there are a lot of traditionalists who believe that we just, as you say, dispassionately provide information and stand aside and wait for the society to react and correct the mistakes, correct the problems. Unfortunately, that works well. Our role as a fourth estate can be described that if the first three estates are functioning. But in most of the countries in the world, I mean, look what's happening in America right now. In most of the societies in the world, three estates are just not functioning properly. In different countries at different levels, and the question is, what do we do? And my argument is that of all four estates, we are probably the most effective, most efficient in standing up for what is important, and for what we believe. And as I said,
democratic values,
exactly,
free speech,
exactly, honesty, decency.
Honest,
truth,
integrity.
Truth, humanity. You know, if we continue like this, as I said, we will extremely precisely, fairly, and dispassionately report from the end of the world. But the idea is that for the world not to end, you know. So I think we are with you for the discussion. What do we do? How we do it? And I believe there are ways that we should actually just talk about how we actually do it on a daily basis.
I'd love to know how you think of so-called investigative journalism. I mean, our experience in building a membership model on The Guardian was that the things that other companies were cutting because it was the most expensive and most troublesome turned out to be the business model. So if you know, we did Snowden, we did WikiLeaks, we did phone hacking, we did undercover policing, we did torture and rendition, all these sort of big stories. So when we went to the readers and said, look, I'm afraid you're going to have to start paying, they said, well, if you're going to do that kind of journalism and you're going to keep it to open everyone, we'll back you. Is that your experience, that as long as you keep doing the job that journalists are supposed to do, that's the big motivation to pay?
Yeah, let me respond to you in two ways. The first way is that you're absolutely correct. The Daily Maverick membership is growing in, you know, leaps and bounces every time we come up with the major investigations. It's just as simple as that. Readers get reminded of the role we play, especially when we have major investigations. And again, so just to clarify, what I think saved Daily Maverick was the fact that for many, many years, we had only one non-editorial employee, which was my business partner, Stili Haralambos, my long-suffering business partner, Stili Haralambos. And even he was, at some stage, the best sport columnist in the country. And because of that, we were such a big editorial unit that we could actually fight against the bigger, much bigger teams. And we were, you know, really good at what we're doing. However, I would caution not to over-evaluate, what is the word? Not to over...
exaggerate them.
Not to exaggerate the importance of investigative journalists, because it is very important. It's crucial. That's where the major things happen. However, people who are doing just good, honest reporting every day. That is the lifeblood of every democracy. We don't have to have every story, which is breaking story, which is changing the world. The stories that are, you know, keeping the world running are very, very important still also. So the reason I'm saying this is that we have a lot of people wanting to, foundations wanting to invest in specific projects. And we said to them, that's very good, but what is going to fund our core business? Because if we don't have a platform, we don't have a core team, we don't have investigations either. So I think it's very important just for us to remember not only investigative journalists are journalists.
I couldn't agree more.
Branko, you're an inspiration to listen to and to talk to. It's been a great pleasure having you on Media Confidential.
Thank you very much.
Well, Branko Brkić, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Maverick, has been operating in a news desert in South Africa for many years. So what he says about media and the importance of holding power to account, standing up for the truth, is really, I think, an important message which goes beyond just what's going on in South Africa.
Completely. A couple of things resonated with me with this business of media literacy. I think we've talked about this before, but I think as journalists, we now have to make the case for how journalism, good journalism, is intrinsic to a good democracy. And we have to help people, I think, at quite a young age to be able to discriminate between what's true and what's not true and why it matters. The second thing, he was right to push back on my little plug for investigative journalism, because I think it is really valued by readers. But I think the more, as it were, bread and butter kind of journalism, this happened, this didn't, this is true, this isn't true. I was there, I saw the sort of the basics of journalism in a country like South Africa with so much disinformation around the place is vital. We've got near to the end of the show. Lionel, we haven't even done the chatter, which I'm slightly dazzled by your tie, Lionel. I have to mention it for our listeners because we haven't got any viewers, but is that not a tie associated with a discriminatory elite club in London? That's very brave to wear it, I have to say.
Well, Alan, as a former member of the Garrick Club, I'm not surprised that you do recognise the Garrick Club tie. And I just want to let you know and reassure all our listeners that I will be voting very shortly in favour of admitting women to the club.
So you're part of the internal struggle.
Indeed, because you resigned under pressure.
On a matter of principle. But anyway, I'm glad to see that the struggle we've been talking about, the struggle in South Africa and the struggle at the Garrick Club goes on, and you're playing your part in it.
Yes, tiny violins in London compared to what's going on.
What else have you noticed has been going on, Lionel?
Well, I'm rather interested in the review, the thematic review of the BBC's migration coverage, which has come out today. I haven't had a chance to read the full report, but I was briefed earlier. And this apparently was instigated partly by your friend, Robbie Gibb, on the...
Robbie.
Yes, he was concerned about the quality and impartiality of migration coverage. And one of the key findings is the BBC needs to produce more high-quality content. There's a danger of impartiality, but they want more context. And the question I have is, if they want more context, why have they closed down their high-quality Home Affairs coverage and gone for this sort of rather waffly Community UK coverage with everybody having to reapply for their jobs? Seems a bit strange. So I'm going to take a look at that.
And close down Newsnight at the same time in its recognisable form. I did an event at the weekend with Jane Martinson, who we've had on this podcast, who has written this fascinating book about the Barclay brothers. And I have to say, this was at the Chipping Campden Literary Festival, talking to Jane for an hour about these characters, the full weirdness of Sir David and Frederick Barclay came out. And not for the first time, I reflected how very strange some of the gatekeepers are to our knowledge and how they get to be there and how odd it was, that huge kerfuffle. I mean, you could understand why it's undesirable to have effectively a sovereign wealth fund owning a newspaper, but the silence that has been over some other very undesirable people is out of, you know, there's a sort of mismatch somewhere between the furore about the Redbird Bid and some of these other rum characters who have and continue to own our national newspapers.
And rum characters who also not based in, domiciled in the UK, they're in the Channel Islands,
and pay taxes.
Avoiders.
Absolutely. Mm. You said it. You said it. I didn't. So you go after Lionel.
I never said the other word, which would have got us into trouble, Alan. That's all for this week. Thank you to Nick Davis and Branko Burkic. We're back next Thursday with more essential analysis of the big media stories. And remember to follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to Media Confidential, brought to you by Prospect Magazine and Fresh Air. You can send any questions or comments to mediaconfidential@prospectmagazine.co.uk or get in touch on X, formerly Twitter. We are at Media Conf Pod.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.